This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcasting at kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Mark Elliott, did a wonderful book a few years ago about Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince. What's great about it is he found a way to sort of separate fact from rumor and present the interesting and the heinous in the matter-of-fact fashion. He does the same in his biography of Cary Grant called simply Cary Grant. Mark, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You know, what's really amazing about the book to me is how much of Grant was about sheer ambition. And how much of what he did and didn't do sort of fell from that. You start the book by talking about how his ambitions to become his own man backfired, and you deal with the whole the honorary Oscar and the fact that he never actually got an Oscar. You talk about why he was kind of ostracized from the business,
right?
Because he chose his own path as a businessman as well as an artist. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Well, most artists in pop culture are business people. A lot of people don't realize that because they only see one side of it. They only see a public facade of it, what's in front of the screen. Cary Grant was very wary, very sharp, and very focused about who he was and who he wasn't. As a child, when he was trying to formulate a personality that worked on a live stage, he chose as his idol, his pretend mentor, Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin's one of the greatest businessmen of all time. And part of what attracted him to Chaplin was the idea that Chaplin was a rebel. And so when Grant followed in his footsteps, literally from the music halls of England to the theatrical stage on Broadway, when he played in the same theater, I believe, at one point on 42nd.
And even to the point of having basically only one parent.
Well, that, of course, a major reason why he was attracted to Chaplin, because he identified early on with the loss of mothers. Both of them experienced strange childhoods of kind of Dickensian proportion that both of them put aside and tried to avoid, although Chaplin glorified his childhood poverty and horrors in The Tramp. He was kind of saying, well, even though he's a tramp, he is a wonderful, sensitive, lovely human being who is thrown out of the pack for it. Grant takes the opposite image and says, sophisticated, warm, impeccably dressed, giving off the impression of great wealth.
But also in Grant, and which you really sort of get at in a lot of ways here, no sentimentality, almost about forward motion.
That's right. So, because the idea of sentimentality is a look backwards, and the look back is too horrible. So the only direction he really cares about is going forward. And that's a little icy sounding. But in fact, he was an icy kind of guy. He wasn't warm. He wasn't gregarious in the public eye. He didn't follow orders very well. His first 7 or 8 movies that he did under the contract at Paramount Pictures, Poverty Row, as they called it, were all the same. He was playing this kind of greasy, sleazy tuxedo.
Basically a gigolo in those movies.
Basically a gigolo. It's a pretty good way to put it. And he didn't like that. And I think one of the reasons he didn't like it,
because it's kind of who he was in the early days.
Who he was.
As you get it very much in the book.
So, you know, keep the camera on me, but don't keep it that close. You know, back it up a little bit and take it off the close-up. And he really wanted to go in a different direction that promoted the myth rather than the reality. And that's why when he left Paramount, during Paramount's reconstruction, when he could get out of it and they really didn't want to re-sign him, he was never going to be Gary Cooper, their number one guy, he went into comedy. Because comedy offered a kind of a warmth that romantic movies didn't for him. And that, of course, did it. Everybody loved this idea of a guy who was so good-looking, so charming, could have anybody and really chose nobody. That was a very appealing aspect to his character, to his persona.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Mark Elliott. His new book is a biography of Cary Grant called Cary Grant. You're talking about all the ways that he was a rebel and his own man. Again, you start the book basically talking about how, because he chose to walk away from Paramount after they wouldn't lend him out to MGM, where he thought he really wanted to be, and star basically Mutiny in the Bounty, which he felt cost him an Oscar nomination, he never again signed with a major studio. He was basically the only major actor of the 30s and 40s not to be tied to a studio. And as a result, the studio system held that against him.
Oh, without question. I mean, the Academy Awards, the whole notion of an academy really came from an anti-union conspiracy by the moguls in 1928 and 29 when the Writers Guild was trying to form and backstage unions were trying to come together, basically because they weren't getting any money. It was a kind of a sweatshop mentality. So the moguls got together and said, look, let's not give them any vacation pay. Let's not give them any medical. Let's not give them any raises. How about a gold statue? I mean, that's what we'll give them, and that'll make them happy. And, of course, the Oscars turned around and became the greatest selling ploy of all time. When he left Paramount in 35 or 36 and signed a couple of non-exclusive contracts with two studios at the same time, basically Columbia and RKO, although he did work independently in addition to that, he was forced to resign from the Academy because the Academy would not acknowledge an actor who was signed to more than one studio. It was considered an inch short of strike-breaking, in terms of its awfulness. And that's why the Academy ostracized him for the rest of his career until Gregory Peck became the first younger generation, more liberal head of the Academy. And in 66.
And in the book, you basically talk about the kind of the trouble, the turmoil he had to surmount to make this thing happen anyway.
You couldn't write a conspiracy that was better than what actually happened. A woman coming out of the blue, accusing him of being pregnant, standing in front of the Academy saying, I'm going to deliver this subpoena. Cary Grant running all over the world trying to escape the notoriety. And, of course, my favorite part of that whole story is Howard Hughes' involvement. Hughes, who flies him everywhere because Hughes, too, a great Hollywood rebel. He finally called Grant in Hollywood and said, you've got to go through with this, because Grant had pulled out two or three times. And Grant said, well, I really don't know. He'd fly to Las Vegas and come and see me personally. He sends the plane. Grant gets on the plane. Grant flies to Vegas. They drive him over to the Desert Inn where Hughes is up there on the top floor in the suite, isolated by now, hair, fingernails. They bring him up, and they put Grant into the next suite, and Hughes calls him on the phone. And that's Hughes' version of a face-to-face meeting in Las Vegas. And that, of course, convinces Grant. He says of something very wise to Grant. You've got to go accept that award, because if you don't, people are going to wonder why he didn't, what the reason was. You've got to go. You've got to do it. Grant hears him, goes and accepts the award, and of course breaks down in tears. I mean, there in the audience is Hitchcock and Hawks and all the people who really meant something to him. Leaves the stage in tears as the spot follows him out. And when the spot goes down, it's the curtain coming down on an era. It was never the same after that, either for Cary Grant or for the film industry.
The book is Cary Grant. Its author is Mark Elliott. It's The Treatment. What's so fascinating to me, and just seeing the excitement in you as you talk about this, how turned on you are by this subject, I mean, and there's so much of it that's seamy. I mean, the Cary Grant, after we get to that opening, when you walk us through and we see the kind of guy his father was, who's kind of withholding, and also in his own way sort of delusional, trying to project this image of being a gentleman, which he really was not, and what we get from that is really is he was kind of responding with his life as a lie to a life that was built on lies, right down to his being told his mother is dead.
Guilt and lies. His mother was very Victorian, brought him up as a Victorian baby. In those days, all the babies were coddled. They had long hair. They were all dressed up in girls' dresses. It was the way it was. The father, meanwhile, was considered below the level of the mother's family standing. She married low, married down.
A pants presser, basically.
A pants presser who was a would-be tailor. And he was a good-time guy. The mother was not a good-time woman. They had a baby before Cary Grant. That baby died, and she thought that was God's message, that this was not a good marriage. So when they got pregnant again, that was probably the last time that the parents knew each other intimately. The young boy, Archie Leach, was really caught between the desire to be with his father, who had left the family and started another life in Southampton, the other side of England, with another woman more suited to him, whom Archie would visit and go out and go to the dance halls and have fun. Back home, he had the guilt for enjoying that side of his father's freedom and performing and popularity by conforming to his mother's rigidity. So he had split loyalties, and he felt guilty about both sides of his loyalties. Then his mother disappears. And they tell him that his mother is dead. In Victorian era, that everything was done to protect a child. It's not till 19 years later, when he's a big star in Hollywood, he's coming to England to get married, bringing Charlie Chaplin's ex-paramour, Virginia Sherrill, back with him to London. I mean, Freud is like the set designer on this part of the story. He gets a message from his father, who he hasn't spoken to in 19 years. All the time, Grant's been in America, creating this new identity, the suave, sophisticated Cary Grant. His father says, I have to see you about a matter of great importance. So Grant figures he's going to be touched up for a few dollars here. He goes, he meets his father. His father says they're having a drink at a pub. First, he's shocked at the way the father looks. He's old and drunken and shriveled and, you know, all of that. And he says, look, I have something very important to tell you. Your mother is not dead. She's alive, and she's in an insane asylum 2 miles from here. Well, I mean, this all but throws Cary Grant into the, you know, the deepest kind of the psychic shock, because when the father got divorced from the mother, or didn't get divorced, had her committed because he couldn't afford to go through a divorce and didn't want the scandal of divorce. So he put the mother in an insane asylum. In those days in Victorian England, if a woman had a headache, she could be committed. And so Grant runs to the asylum, retrieves his mother, and the deeper shock, perhaps, is that she really doesn't know who he is anymore. The 19 years that she spent in the asylum has made her crazy. And so for the rest of his life, he tries to clarify her love for him, and not very successfully.
I should mention that you detail this life as a life of basically sort of spiraling in and out of depressions.
Yeah.
I mean, for any number of reasons, for failed relationships with other men, with other women, with that trip back to London, which he thinks is going to be a big deal to announce his marriage, and he finds out about his mother, which details another kind of depression.
The suicidal depression.
Was that what really first drew you to the material, that he really was a man of a sort of incredible sort of dark melancholy?
Well, that's part of it. What really drew me to Cary Grant as a subject was that after I wrote the Walt Disney book in 93...
Well, first of all, were you shocked at the kind of horrible stuff you found out about Walt Disney? Or did
you completely shocked. I was looking for a subject that was light and fun. And I said to myself, well, who is more light and who is more fun than Walt Disney? But the reaction to the book was so shocking to me, because I dared to say that Walt Disney was not good old Uncle Walt, that he had, in fact, done some not so great things in his life. And, you know, to look at his life as a serious biographer is to look at a photo that isn't touched up for distribution, like an 8x10 glossy.
But very much like Cary Grant, a guy whose private life utterly contradicted his personal life.
Utterly. There was so little connection that the only connection you could make would be artistic, filling in the gaps, and I mean the physical gaps, where nothing existed for Walt Disney. He made something. But if you look at his feature animation films, the films that count as Walt Disney movies, mm-hmm. Missing Parents, Children Who Were Adopted, children who witnessed their parents murdered.
A fear of abandonment, a constant fear of abandonment.
A fear of never been. A fear of maybe these aren't my parents at all. Disney lived with a lifelong fear that he had actually been adopted. And then the FBI stuff and the Uncle Walt stuff, turning on his own company because they unionized, and he feeling that his own children had killed him. You see, so there is a way to look at this that forms an interesting pattern. After that book, and as I say, it went all over the world and the reputation was huge, I wanted to do, again, a Hollywood biography that was nice and light and fun.
We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Mark Elliott. His great new book is Cary Grant, a biography. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Shake it, don't
break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Mark Elliott. His wonderful new book is Cary Grant, a biography. You were talking about what drew you to this. You were looking for an antidote to finding out that Walt Disney was among the worst human beings ever to draw breath in Southern California. And I guess I should say to people who get going here that some of the stuff that was kind of the mythology about him. If you go to California, you hear some of these rumors about him being an awful guy, and you got to sort of run all the stuff down and find out that much of it was true.
Well, California's ground zero for anti-Disney. I mean, the closer you get to where he actually lived, the worse it gets. I mean, and he's not the only one. But I managed to find, you see, it's very difficult to write a biography about Walt Disney because so much licensing takes place and so much usurpation. A writer comes in and says, I want to write about Walt Disney. Fine, we'll license the book. We'll give you everything you need. But we get final approval. You know, I didn't.
They spoon feed you the stuff they want you to have.
And they take and they edit out what they don't want. So all biographies about Walt Disney basically are the same, except mine, because I said, okay, you know, I don't need your photos of Mickey Mouse.
We could say the same thing about this Cary Grant book too.
There's
it's a kind of a fear of revealing things, and you even like get to you detail the infamous sort of Chevy Chase outing of Cary Grant on the Tomorrow Show in the early 80s.
I remember that. I remember when it happened. I remember watching the TV because I actually worked on that show.
You worked on the Tomorrow Show?
I was one of the producers of the Tomorrow Show out west when I was back in 1980. I remember seeing that happen and turning to a friend of mine and saying, get the lawyers on the phone. You know, this is lawsuit time.
Now tell this is exactly what happened.
Chevy Chase, who, you know, oddly enough, was touted by a lot of people in the early 80s as being the next Cary Grant. He was good-looking, he had a great screen presence, and he could do light comedy. And so they said, well, here, at last, you know, is the next Cary Grant. And he was on with Tom Snyder, who was a kind of a boozy, you know, fun guy, and, you know, he's kind of soft newsy and all
and
that.
And that show definitely felt like everybody had gone home and anything could happen.
It was late hours. It was Larry King and Aaron Brown combined at 3 o'clock in the morning.
If you throw in a little bit of cable access, you kind of feel too.
It really was a perfect pre-cable show. It's really what it was. Smoking, you know, booze in the cups, all of that. Anyway, they got to talking, and for some reason, Chevy Chase called Cary Grant a fag. Even Tom, who usually got a big yuck out of all that kind of stuff, said, are you sure you mean that? He tried to get him off that. And the more he tried to get him off, the harder down Chevy Chase came. I mean, Chase had just come to Hollywood. He'd been in New York for a while, you know, and Chicago and Canada, and heard the rumors, you know, and probably all this association with Cary Grant probably made him a little bit uneasy and wanted to establish that he was, you know, uber heterosexual. Grant sued him, and that was a pretty big case because Grant had taken a lot from the press through the years. The studios used the press to regulate actors.
And you get a lot in the book about basically how it was like basically an open secret and kinds of extortion and blackmail go back and forth between the columnists.
So, I mean, and you learn to take it because if you didn't, you didn't work. And Grant, you know, he kind of took it. But he'd go out with Randolph Scott, his longtime live-in partner, to a Halloween party dressed as a woman. I mean, there were things that he would do that would just make the studios crazy. So here I am looking for a way to get out of the darkness myself and stop writing these books about these lunatics. I go down to the Film Forum in New York City, Revival House, because they're showing a scope version of North by Northwest, which I had never seen. It was the first time in years that I couldn't figure out how the rabbit came out of the hat, because here was Cary Grant doing the most incredible performance by doing almost nothing in a plot where he doesn't exist, where he is created by the head of the CIA, who is kind of a Hitchcock surrogate, and grows into this image of this flamboyant CIA spy until by the end of the film he becomes that spy. He gets the girl, Eva Marie Saint. They go off on that train through the tunnel, and the guy he was in the beginning, Rogers O. Zero Thornhill, ceases to exist. And I, by the end of that movie, I said, this is somebody I really want to know more about. That is the most amazing thing I've ever seen, that 2 hours that I just witnessed. And so that's what brought me to Cary Grant. Of course, you know, as with any biography of a serious performer and artist, it's never going to be a clean, easy page of sweet and lightness. There's depth there. Sometimes the depth gets confused with the darkness. Sometimes the depth is the darkness. But with Cary Grant, the art of his film work, his own creation of this character, this persona that ran through 60 of his 72 movies, to me was worth a couple of years of my life to find out about.
It's the treatment. My guest is Mark Elliott. His book that we're talking about here is Cary Grant, biography. I'm glad you brought up the Hitchcock stuff, because I was going to, because what you deal with in the chapters on Hitchcock is how basically Hitchcock dealt with the duality in his personality, that sort of the darkness and light, that kind of essentially closeted part of himself, that sort of waking fiction versus who he really was. And Hitchcock in Notorious, in North by Northwest, I mean, Hitchcock was really quite good at using that. And you make the case that you think that Hitchcock's greatest on-screen creation was his understanding of those sides of Cary Grant and how he could use them in those movies.
Absolutely. He made four films with Cary Grant: Suspicion, Notorious, To Catch a Thief, and North by Northwest. And they're kind of the same film.
And even Catch a Thief, basically dealing with his attraction towards very young women. I mean, so
exactly.
even inadvertently, Hitchcock knew who Cary Grant was.
And his ambivalence. Is he a thief or is he not a thief? Is he a good guy? In Suspicion, is he a killer or is he really a good guy? In Notorious, is he as awful as he seems or is he the guy at the end who saves her from what he put her into? Hitchcock's greatness, to me, is shooting the subtext as text. You know, in everyday life, you have a fight with someone, I wish I could kill that guy. In a Hitchcock film, you kill that guy. You know, I mean, that's the difference. You play that wishful subtext as text. You look at The Strangers on a Train. It's probably the most blatant example of someone saying, oh, I wish I could strangle her. And the next minute, she's strangled by his dark other, his other dark doppelganger twin. So with Grant, when Hitchcock came to America, because there was no more film industry in London once the war began, and David O. Selznick wanted to sign him up, he said, who would you like to work with? And Hitchcock said, well, Cary Grant, you know, British like him, and more. He saw something in Grant. So Selznick threw a party at the 21 Club, marches Grant in. Hitchcock takes one look at him and says, aha, I get it. That's me, except tall, dark, and handsome. He said, but inside there, I see it clear as day. And, of course, Grant takes a shining to Hitchcock because of that and says, Hitchcock is me, except he's short, fat, and ugly. So together, they're able to play the inside as the outside because Grant had his Hitchcock had Grant's number. And Grant gave it to him. He wrote it down on a piece of paper. He'd call me sometime. And so those movies they made are probably the closest to who Cary Grant really was.
But I'm going to ask you, because you're so matter-of-fact about the stuff with Randolph Scott, about the awful stuff about basically the house in Santa Monica and all that kind of stuff, and really about how Cary Grant was kind of a trade when he lived in New York, when he had roommates. Were you concerned that people would just sort of gravitate towards that stuff instead of seeing it as a part of the Cary Grant that you were trying to depict in the book?
Yes. I purposely chose not to be prurient, so that this would not come off as
sensational,
like the Monty Cliff book 20 years ago, sure, that people remember only because he was like a beautiful woman in that book, and his entanglement with his gayness really reached out on the screen and was translated by 50s critics as sensitivity. I didn't want to go that route because that really does not inform most of the characters that, or all the characters that Grant played on screen. His ambivalence was somewhere else. It was focused somewhere else. Namely, that his beautiful physique, his beautiful physical being, was no match for the kind of crumbled, hollow inside.
But you even get to that by dealing with his obsessiveness with cleanliness.
Absolutely.
Brushing teeth all the time.
That's right.
Washing up all the time.
That's right. He, you know, it's a contradiction. He was polishing an image that he didn't like, but he was polishing anyway because the business smart side of him said, that's your moneymaker, you know. But the other side of him knew that the more you paint an old car, the more it looks like a new car. So the inside, he wasn't that interested in having people look too deep, but he wanted to be accepted as a real person. So that's where his conflicts came from. Part of it certainly was the homosexuality. I mean, where after Randolph Scott left, after an 11-year relationship, men kind of disappear from his life. You could say that the most important man in Cary Grant's life after Randolph Scott is Alfred Hitchcock. So it becomes a creative, artistic choice rather than an emotional choice of intimacy. And that's part of the fascination. That's part of the great thing about doing a biography is that you get to see the development of where the power of one's emotion as an artist is refocused and relocated. I mean, to a point where Grant, at the age of 62 in 1966, at the peak of his career, really is from North by Northwest until Walk Don't Run, he made the most money he ever made in movies. And those movies, those five or six movies that he made, or seven movies, are among the top 12 all-time moneymakers of his films. So really, he gets more popular and walks away from it because he says that he'd want to play older men. He didn't want to be the uncle or the Dorian Gray thing. But really, in another way, his artistic energy was spent in that.
Except, and we're talking to Mark Elliott about his book, Cary Grant, a Biography. You talk about that those last, essentially the last sort of 10, 15 years of his life, where he becomes Cary Grant TM, basically taking a touring show around the country and playing Cary Grant to live audiences for like not a whole lot of money because he can't really walk away from that.
Well, he only did that for a year when he was he started in 81. He began as a favor to Steve Allen, who got sick at the last minute and asked Cary Grant, of all people, if he would go fill in at some college in California. But what he really did was, through the use of LSD, which he was a pioneer user in all the experiments in the early 50s in California with Aldous Huxley, that really was what did it for Cary Grant. That was a deeper focus than any screen lens or camera lens. That connected him, and that's where the action was. So he walks away from movies and suddenly starts a family at the age of, 65. He's having a baby where other men are having them at 25. It takes him another 40 years to be able to get there, and then marries younger women and takes a job with
Fabergé.
Does all these things that he never had done in life as almost to catch up with the life he never lived. So his last 20 years from 66 to 86 are fascinating for what he does do and what he doesn't do. And then Grant decides, he takes Steve Allen's offer and he turns it into the final memory piece because he takes that show, that one-man show, which is really just Cary Grant, a few clips, and Grant sitting on a stool talking to young college kids, to all the towns and villages that he played when he was a kid in vaudeville, when he toured with the Penda Group in America. So he really completes the cycle and goes back and tries to recreate again a life that he didn't have.
That's the perfect place to end it. We're out of time. Mark, thank you so much for being here. The book is great.
Thanks.
My guest is Mark Elliott. His book is Cary Grant, a Biography. Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance at Carnegie Recording Studios and Karen Perlman. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell, not Cary Grant. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.